We're going to go on to verse 21 tonight. And you, then being alienated ones and enemies in respect to the understanding in your evil works, but now he has reconciled in the body of his flesh through death to present you holy and unblameable and unreprovable before him. If indeed you continue in the faith with a foundation under you and established and not moved from the hope of the gospel which you've heard, which has been preached in all creation, which is under heaven, of which I, Paul, have become a minister. Now, just to lift this out again for you, here is the substantial story of the gospel, the message of God to man, that we were alienated. That's one of the big words. You could almost tell the story in a few words. We were created, and then alienated, and then reconciled, and then glorified, you see, brought back to God. We were alienated from God and were then therefore unable to continue the purposes for which God had originally created us. And then by the plan of redemption or reconciliation, we were put in a position of being glorified. God's original purpose for us was unto a certain kind of glorification. We lost that possibility in the fall. We lost that potential within us, but it was restored, of course, through the redemption of Christ. So now we are in a position once again to be glorified. Well, that's the whole story of man. He was created a creature of great glory. He was then alienated in the fall and now restored to that position, although the final glorification waits for the future. And what that glorification ultimately really means is a question. We can talk about it, but we don't really know. The Bible says, eye has not seen nor ear heard, neither entered into the heart of man the things that God hath prepared for them that love him. Then he goes on to say, but God has revealed them to us by his Spirit. We have an apprehension, we have a comprehension in our spirits. The reason I use it apprehension is that I'm thinking of being, of apprehending something. We have a word in English, apprehensive, which means that we're a little bit uneasy about something. We say, well, I'm apprehensive about that. We mean we're a little uneasy. But to apprehend something means to take it in. That's why I use the word apprehend, because it's more than comprehend, since comprehend has to do with our mind, with our understanding. Apprehend is something we appropriate with our spirits. What I want to say to you is that we have appropriated something in our spirits that our minds do not always keep pace with. See, funneling the truth of God through the mind can beggar it, can lessen it, minimize it. There are times when we have to merely move in the substantive truth of God in our spirit without really fully taking in our minds what it's all about. And I think that's very much like what happens even in the space vehicles, where the men, the space astronauts, understand the workings of the equipment, of course, pretty thoroughly, but they still couldn't tell you what are the physics principles behind it. They speculate on that, but they don't really. It's still rather mysterious how these vehicles remain in the air, how they keep on their course and all of that. So a lot of things that the astronauts are participating in. I picked that area because it is one of those areas where we have done outstanding work, and yet in the use of the principles, and yet the principles still remain a mystery to us. See? Now, our minds are unable to fully measure the implications of what is going on in our spirit. But things are happening in our spirits that are vital and substantive and dependable, and far more dependable than our mental comprehension. That's why I keep telling people you're really better off just to go about your work and trust the Lord to do what He wants inside of you than try to figure out processes of sanctification and do them. See? What I mean by that, the pursuit of spirituality is best done by the recognition that spirituality means that there's a functioning of God going on in our spirits that we probably can't even get involved with too much. We can't affect it ourselves. If we try it, it's artificial. When we go through the systems, begging the pardon of whoever may be listening that's so enamored of it, systems like the Navigator system or some of these where they've got their charts and their manuals and their daily exercises and so forth, in a certain sense, that can be seen as a manipulation of the spirit by the flesh that really more tends to get in the way of what we're doing. For example, when we talk on a telephone, we're best just to talk in a normal voice, right? If we try to help that electromagnetic process along by shouting, you see, we may say, well, this person's in San Diego. Or when I talk to my wife in Los Angeles tonight, I'd better shout a little louder because it's further to San Diego than Ventura. When I talk from Ventura, I'm talking a little more normal. Well, that's what I see in the mechanistic, the mechanical approach to Christianity today, which is to sharpen up our spirituality. We can't do it. We only get in the way. But what we can do is plug in unit. And another figure, our job is the nourishment. It's like when you eat your food. If you sit there at the table for an hour after you eat and try to think through the process of assimilation, you know, let's see, now that French fry is in the lower gastrointestinal tract, and now if you try to use biofeedback to effect the digestive process, you're going to slow it down for one thing. Another thing, you're going to get it all confused. There is something going on here that is quite beyond the capacity of our understanding that God is doing in the reconciliation process. As we see Paul's discussion here, and as we continue in this book, we will find later on that he makes a very special point of the problem of people who attempt to achieve spirituality by the flesh. That is, by touch not, taste not, handle not, you know, by presentations of the religious variety, the ascetic variety, thinking you're going to be more holy for being an ascetic. There might be a lot of reasons to control your diet, to control your eating habits. There might be some fair reasons for fasting in the natural sense. There are reasons for doing that, but none of them have to do with making you more spiritual. There are a lot of reasons for doing things that make you, that control your life processes, and a lot of reasons for disciplining your life. But disciplining it will not make it more spiritual. So the only thing that can make it more spiritual is the spirit. And there's nothing you can do to boost the spirit in you. Just take him in and give yourself to the nourishment of the Word. The simple truth of the Word is, of the Gospel, that we have been alienated and made enemies in our understanding in evil works. The word works is used throughout the Greek language, classical and Koine, biblical Greek, and so forth. That word work is used in a very broad sense for something that is going on inside of one. When he talks about wicked works or evil works, he's not talking about going out and playing the slot machines, the one-armed bandits, or doing things of this type. He's talking about a process of evil that is going on inside. We were alienated, not because we went out, because one goes out and does something that is unsound. It is evil because there is an evil process going on in the heart. Now, when Christ comes along, he stops that evil process. We were enemies because of our evil works, that is, the evil process going on inside of it. But now, he has reconciled us in the body of his flesh through death. Now, when I said you were enemies, in your mind, in your dianoia here, in your understanding, those things that pass through the mind. The Greek word here for understanding means the process of thinking, that which is passing through your mind. We have our natural mind, which is different than our spirit. And that's what I talked about earlier when I said in our natural minds, we can't really process the things of God. We can't take them in. But by that same natural mind, we do possess the capacity to think evil. The Greek word dianoia here means to something that is passing through the mind, is being chewed up by the mind, digested by the mind, so forth. So I've talked to you before here in this meeting about the process of thinking, where you see an object and electric impulses or electromagnetic impulses come through your nervous system and pick up on the data that is in the cortex and make a judgment about that data. We call that integration in psychology, the SIR formula, stimulus integration response. It means that you pick up on the stimuli from an outside environment, from the external environment, and then it goes through the brain and is processed there, and we make our judgments about it, and then we have react to those judgments by our responses. The motor nerves carry out the wishes of the brain, which have come to us as a result of what we've processed. Say, if you find that you're holding your picnic on an anthill, for example, a process begins here where the stimulus brings an evaluation in your mind, and your brain tells your feet to get a move and get you out of there fast. That's the stimulus integration response, SIR formula of psychology. The mind, then, is that processing mechanism or unit. But Paul says that we were enemies in our minds. You see, the things that were going through our minds were not of God, and they were stimulated by evil. But now he says you've been reconciled in the body of your flesh. That is, changed from one thing to another. It's a simple Greek word here, to reconcile. We have been alienated from God, now we're changed back into a relationship with him. And that was done in the body of his flesh through death. Jesus' death on the cross, of course, is what paved the way for us. To present you holy and unblameable and unreprovable. Very interesting. Most of us look at the word unblameable and we say, well, I can never be blameless. How can that ever be? The answer is simple. There's a difference between being blameless and being evil. We are blameless not because we're any good, but because through Christ the judgment has been taken away from us. Sentence of death that we had in ourselves has been removed, so we are blameless. If you go to court and the judge dismisses the case, even if you were guilty, you're now blameless. There's no further statement by the court in regard to your guilt. That's how he can present us blameless and unreprovable or unchargeable is that word. Best thing to do here would be to turn to Romans chapter 8, start with verse 31. What then shall we say to these things? If God is for us, who is against us? He who did not spare his own son, but delivered him up for us all, how shall he not with him also freely give us all things, or give freely all things to us? Who shall reprove God's elect? I'm using the same word that you probably have in your translation in the King James. I think it says in the King James in the verse in Colossians that we would be holy and unblameable and unreprovable in his sight. Isn't that unreprovable before him? Do any of you have the King James translation? What do you have there, Jeff? Unreprovable?
Yes.
All right. Now, it's the exact same word that you have in Romans 8:33. Who shall reprove God's elect, you see? Or if we would use the best translation for this word in Colossians, we would say unchargeable. Unchargeable. So here you could say, who shall charge God's elect? Who shall lay anything to the charge of God's elect? So we are unchargeable because the charges have been removed. And also this hagios in the first part presents you holy. The word holy, as I've explained many times, means separated unto God. It doesn't mean pious. It doesn't necessarily mean that you're without fault. Now again, this unblameable is a difference between being without fault and being without blame. We are without blame because Christ already took the penalty, but we are not without fault. See? That's the difference. But we are this, if indeed, it says, you remain in the faith founded, that is, with a foundation under you, and established, and be not removed from the hope of the gospel which you've heard. And I have to once again remind you that it's careless, would be careless for me as a representative of God to say to you that no one could ever walk away from God. We're really wrong to get ourselves twisted up in these extra-biblical terminologies. People use things like eternal security and all that sort of thing. Those are not scriptural terms, so they get people all fouled up. So let's forget those terms, and let us simply say this, again, as I've already said to you, if good deeds doesn't save you, the lack of good deeds is not what loses your salvation. See? You can't be saved by good deeds, therefore, by the same token, you can't be lost by not good deeds. See? The only way you can be saved is by taking Christ into your life. The only way you could be lost would be by bidding him depart. Now, he does not just simply walk out on people. In all fairness and honesty, I have to say to you that if the Lord decided that the person who was bidding him leave really meant it, made no bones about it, possibly he would leave. Why not? Why not? But that does not mean the person that just gets frustrated and make some careless statement, say, well, Lord, you might as well leave me because I'm no good, and that sort of thing. He doesn't listen to that kind of talk. But if he knew that you were absolutely certainly of the opinion you didn't want him in your life anymore, and you bid him depart and forgot about him, I couldn't say that you couldn't be lost. To say anything otherwise would just be using words, you know. We're not big enough to say that. I'm not big enough to say to you what God would do. I don't expect that to happen. I haven't seen it happen, except in maybe one or two cases. I've seen some that I would be pretty... It would not surprise me at all if they were now out of the faith altogether. I've seen it. But I don't know whether it's going to stick eternally or not. They might come back. As of the present time, the persons I'm thinking about have bid Christ depart, have disowned Christ, and have no interest and are ridiculing, in fact, the things of God and ridiculing his servants and so forth. Now, that kind of person, I have to say, might be lost. But believe me, it's not a question of walking a tightrope here so that the first time you breathe out of the left side of your nostril instead of the right, that you're going to be thrown out of the kingdom. But there are a lot of people that feel that way. Every time they make a mistake, they think, oh, I must not be a Christian. Well, being a Christian has nothing to do with whether you are always walking the chalk line or not. And if you be not removed from the hope of the gospel which you have heard, the gospel which has been proclaimed in all creation, it's an announcement, a heraldic announcement of things, which is all creation which is under heaven, of which I, Paul, have become a minister. The word diakonos just means a servant, which I have become a servant. Paul's entire life was given to the process of serving Christ. It is a term that is used of Stephen and the others in the book of Acts, where they suggest the appointing of deacons. Our English word deacon comes immediately from this word diakonos. Paul has become a servant of this gospel, which has been preached. But now he says, I rejoice in my sufferings on your behalf. I don't know whether you have in your King James text, my sufferings. Do you have my sufferings? All right, that's a correct translation, even though there's no possessive here. Now I rejoice in my sufferings on your behalf and fill up that which is lacking of the afflictions of Christ in my flesh on behalf of his body, which is the church. Now, do you know, have any idea what that means? To fill up the afflictions of Christ. Fill up what is a lacking of you. Well, the point of the matter here is that there is a certain schedule or slate of suffering which we go through as Christians. The Lord knows how much each of us can stand, but the Scripture says if we suffer, we shall also reign with him. We go through sufferings on the earth, not necessarily physical punishments or penalties, but sufferings in terms, for example, of what our adherence to the faith costs us in family and so forth. For example, there's a young man in another city that wants to come to the Institute, but his wife's not a Christian. And he's become a Christian. Well, he suffers much because his wife is not a Christian, you see. He has much conflict and much difficulty. That's part of his sufferings. There is that slate of sufferings which the Lord allows each person to go through. And he knows what your slate of sufferings is, and until you actually fulfill that slate of sufferings, you still there's some lacking of the afflictions of Christ in you, you see. That's not anything you can help. It's just that you have a certain course to run, and you're going to run it. He fills this up in his flesh, in my sarx. The demands of the Spirit affect the flesh. It's not a happy union at all. Now, a husband who has become a Christian, like the one I'm mentioning to you, who wants to, say, go to seminary and then into the ministry, let us say, that person is going to cause distress to the people that are attached to him, that are associated with him, by the nature of the matter. There's going to be distress. By the same token, having a spirit that is committed to Christ brings about embarrassments to our flesh. It's an unholy union. Fortunately, the day is coming when that flesh of ours is going to be cast aside and we'll have a glorified body. But right now, the flesh gives us trouble, and it's an unhappy union, and a lot of our suffering is the result of that. The spirit wars against the flesh, and the flesh against the spirit, and these are contrary one to the other. That's why you're going to fight as long as you're a Christian, as long as you live on the earth. I don't care what people say. You can go, you can listen to the greatest minister or preacher or man of God in the country or the world, and you can listen to the greatest one, and if he tries to tell you that you can get to a point in your Christian life where everything is lovely and you're not going to suffer because of the flesh, he's lying. It's not true. You do not come necessarily to tranquility in the flesh, ever. You have peace in the spirit. But Jesus, right before the cross, We're working on that now in the commentary. In the 12th chapter of John says, now is my soul troubled. Now, what he said is, my soul has come to a troubled state. Greek text allows that, rather than just, it's not a momentary flash where Jesus says, well, I'm a little bit troubled today because I've been thinking about some things. His soul had come to trouble, to be troubled. Jesus had trouble all the time when he was on the earth. The Christian person that thinks he can come to a place where he's always sweet and lovely, everything is always sweet and lovely, is missing it. There are people that try to put that out, you know, that you really trust Christ, you should never worry, you should never have any trouble, just go along in a sweet world. But that's not true of the Word. Paul struggled all his life. He suffered all his life. And part of his suffering was this conflict between flesh and spirit. That's why we wrote that book, The Struggle. It's going to be a struggle all your life. Although I heard from a young man who waited on a woman in a store where these books of mine were being out on the counter. They're not sold, but they were out on the counter. The Struggle, and she picked it up and she looked at it and she said, oh well, she said, it's a struggle until you get into Romans 8, but after you get into Romans 8, it's no more a struggle, you see. That's wrong. It's false teaching. This woman happens to do a lot of Bible teaching. God help her poor subjects. But she's wrong. You're going to struggle all your life in Christ because your flesh wars against the Spirit. And Paul said he had to keep his flesh under. Now, you discipline your flesh, not because they're going to make you more spiritual, but if you don't, you're going to be in trouble. Well, flesh will get you into trouble every time. Get your life all tangled up. So you discipline it. But it's always out there. Always tripping you up. And if you realize it, then you're smart. Then you'll hang in there. But Paul, in the flesh, suffered. And he said he's down here on the earth filling up the tank of suffering, taking his lumps. Someday he would be soon rid of all of that, but during the time he wrote this book, he was still suffering. He said, I fill up the afflictions of Christ in my flesh on behalf of his body, which is the church. Not on behalf of Jesus' physical body, but on behalf of the church, which is his real body. Do you realize how incomplete Christ is without the church? He's like a head without a body. That's a voluntary submissiveness on his part, or voluntary limiting. We're the body of Christ. Paul's sufferings are on behalf of the body. As we suffer in the flesh, we are doing our part to express Christ in the body. This earth is a place of suffering. We testify to the grace of Christ when we hold steady in the midst of that suffering.